This is the Healthy Living Podcast on OWL Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center. OWL Radio broadcasts to homes in San Antonio, the Hill Country, in San Antonio Methodist Hospitals, and via online streaming and smartphone access. Welcome. I am Martha Attee. This Healthy Living Podcast is being recorded on September 29, 2023. Our first article is from the New York Times from May of 2023, and it is titled, Secrets of a Healthy Breakfast. Each day, an estimated 10 to 20% of adults in the United States skip breakfast. And that, nutrition experts say, may be a mistake. Not only does a morning meal provide the fuel you need to start your day, but numerous studies have found that eating breakfast regularly is associated with a range of health benefits. These include reduced risk for obesity, cardiovascular disease, and type 2 diabetes, as well as improved short-term memory in adults, better school performance in children, and better diet quality all overall. So says Catherine Starr, a registered dietitian and associate professor of medicine at Duke University School of Medicine. All of our meals are important. I don't think breakfast is the most important meal, said Dr. Starr, but it, quote, kicks off the process for our body to function properly. To maintain healthy blood sugar, energy, and fullness levels until your next meal, getting the right balance of protein, fiber, and unsaturated fats at breakfast is important, says registered dietitian Lauren Harris Pincus, who is from New Jersey. This roughly translates to at least 20 grams of protein, 8 to 10 grams of fiber, and 10 to 15 grams of unsaturated fats, totaling about 300 to 350 calories. But it's important not to get hung up on these numbers, said Professor of Nutrition and Science Policy Alice H. Lichtenstein, who works at the Friedman School of Nutrition Science at Tufts University. She's saying, your nutrient needs will depend on your weight, activity level, age, and your health conditions. More important, she said, is focusing on what you enjoy and what makes you feel energized and sated. Quote, so many times we've tried to give people formulas, and if you look at dietary patterns and scores in the United States, we're not doing that well as far as diet quality goes. So what's the ideal breakfast? Dr. Lichtenstein said, it's whatever makes your body work best. So, pay attention to protein. One thing to prioritize when planning your morning meal, said Ms. Harris Pincus, is protein. Many Americans consume more than enough protein throughout the day, but they often don't get enough at breakfast. They instead opt for foods high in refined sugars or other carbohydrates, such as bagels, pastries, or energy bars. If they do prioritize protein, they frequently choose foods high in saturated fats, such as bacon or sausage, which can increase the risk for cardiovascular disease. Your body needs protein to maintain your muscle mass, metabolism, and physical strength, among other things. But it can only use about 25 to 35 grams of protein per meal for those purposes. If you consume more protein in one sitting, your body will either use it as energy, or store it as fat, or excrete it. So if you skip breakfast or don't eat protein at breakfast, you lose that opportunity because you can't double up on that protein later. And don't forget the shortfall nutrients. Calcium, vitamin D, potassium, and fiber are commonly called the shortfall nutrients because people in the United States often don't get enough of them. Over time, deficiencies in such nutrients can lead to a variety of problems, including weak bones, poor gut health, and high blood pressure. But it so happens that many healthy breakfast foods in the United States are packed with those nutrients. Most fortified cow's milk contains calcium, vitamin D, and potassium. Most fortified cereals contain vitamin D. Just be sure to choose those high in fiber and low in added sugars. Other nutrients, bananas, citrus, and many dried fruits have potassium, and oats are rich in fiber. So when you think about something like a bowl of whole grain cereal and milk with some fruit, that really makes a dent in those shortfall nutrients. Make breakfast into whatever you want it to be. You don't have to confine yourself to standard breakfast fare to get a mix of nutrients in the morning, said Joseph Connolly Shunan, a director of nutrition at Stony Brook Medicine. Any whole plant-based food is going to have lots of phytonutrients. These are antioxidants that protect your cells from damage. These foods also contain fiber, which helps you stay full and supports gut health. Coffee and tea can also provide some antioxidants and be part of a nutritious breakfast. Just don't overdo it on the sugar and cream. Amanda Sauceda, a registered dietitian in Long Beach, California, is a proponent of expanding breakfast to include anything you might eat at any other time of the day. I don't like breakfast food, but I hate how my body feels if I don't eat breakfast. Her go-to morning meal is often a version of the previous night's dinner, which might have been Chinese food or grilled chicken and vegetables. She said, "I've been known to eat whatever we had the night before and wrap it in a tortilla and make a burrito. I'm still getting my food groups, even though it might not be what you traditionally eat for breakfast." Dr. Connolly Shunan said that taking your time and enjoying your food is important. Eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. And breakfast doesn't have to be the first thing in the morning. If you wake up and go to an exercise class at 7:30 a.m., you might have a few bites of something if you're hungry, go to class and come back and then finish breakfast. Find whatever works for you. Here are some ideas to try to change up the breakfast. A whey protein smoothie with kale or spinach, fruit, and Greek yogurt. Whole wheat toast with your favorite type of nut butter and sliced strawberries. Greek yogurt with slivered almonds or walnuts and berries. A whole wheat breakfast burrito that has a mix of eggs and egg whites, cheese, beans, and some salsa. Steel-cut oats or a high-fiber cereal with milk. You can add whey protein powder, almonds or walnuts, and a sliced melon. Tofu scramble with skim mozzarella cheese, vegetables, avocado, and whole wheat toast. Leftover grilled chicken, roasted potatoes, and green beans. and roasted potato slices on a bed of spinach topped with an egg. And we'll continue on the Healthy Living podcast with an article from the Nutrition Action newsletter for September-October 2023. It's titled, 5 Exercise Questions, Getting the Most Out of Your Workout. Why do we care about our core? One of the major disadvantages of having a weak core is low back pain, says David Bim, a professor in the School of Human Kinetics and Recreation at Memorial University of Newfoundland in Canada. The local muscles are trying to anticipate movement so that the ligaments between the vertebrae don't get stretched out or damaged. But if the local muscles are weak, they can't adequately support the ligaments. This can lead to an injury or chronic lower back pain. The good news is, working the deep core can help stabilize the lower back and ease low back pain. So, to do this, target your deep core. To build core stability, Dr. Bim suggests an exercise called hollowing. When you get in a seated position, pull your belly button back towards your spine and pretend you're trying to have a bowel movement, he says. That makes the deep core muscles work really hard. Add a functional exercise or exercises. Squats, deadlifts, and lunges engage your core. They're functional because they mimic movements that you do every day, like bending down to pick up something. Introduce instability. If you're doing crunches, you're working the global muscles, but you're just lying on the floor so your local muscles don't have to work very hard. You want to put them under some stress by creating instability. For example, planks are great, but how often are you just holding yourself in one position? Instead, do planks while raising one foot or one hand at a time off the ground. Add some rotation. If you're hitting a tennis serve or even just reaching across your body to grab a cup out of the cupboard, you're rotating your core. Build those muscles by doing bicycle crunches or standing wood chops. What happens when you sprain an ankle, pull a muscle, or hit your thumb with a hammer? Initially, you get damage to the injured structure, which could be the muscle, a tendon, or ligament, says Susan Quaison, manager of clinical research at the Nicholas Institute of Sports Medicine and Athletic Trauma in Manhattan. That primary injury leads to inflammation and other damage to nearby tissue, creating a secondary injury. If you've suffered a sprain, muscle pull, or other similar injury, you've probably heard that you should RICE, RICE, which stands for rest, ice, compress, and elevate. But does RICE work? First, we'll look at rest. In the acute stage after an injury, say the first 2 hours or so, you should probably rest, says Dr. Quaison. But as time progresses, active recovery is much better. You want to move around as much as your injury allows. If you have pain, back off. But you don't want to be stagnant. When it comes to managing an injury, remember motion is lotion and rest is rust. Now we go to ice. No human trials have tested icing immediately after an injury. It's hard to do that type of research in people. You're not going to injure people just to study if ice works. But animal studies suggest that if you're going to ice, you need to do it quickly. Quote, that first 30 minutes may be a window of opportunity to intervene and shorten the inflammatory stage of the injury, says Dr. Quaison. If you're not icing right away, you're probably missing the ball. The good news is, a lot of animal studies show that icing reduces inflammation. And icing repeatedly, not just one time, reduces the size of the secondary injury. Want to give ice a chance? To start, ice as soon as possible, but no more than 20 minutes at a time. Wrap the ice pack in cloth rather than applying it directly to your skin. Icing for longer than 20 minutes comes with the risk of skin-related cold injury like frostbite. Remove the ice for 30 to 40 minutes and then repeat. Ice for the first 6 hours, even 12 hours if you can. But beyond the first day, there's no point in using ice except for its pain-relieving properties. If you're using ice for pain, use it for as long as you'd like. A safety note, however, if you're shivering, stop icing. That's an alarm bell that your body is in danger. What about compression and elevation? Can wrapping and elevating your injury, let's say it's the ankle, speed your recovery? In theory, compression prevents swelling and elevation helps drain excess fluid away from your injury. On its own, compression doesn't seem to help, though wrapping an ice pack around the injury may improve ice-to-skin contact and help lower the temperature of the tissue. But elevating an injury doesn't do much to speed recovery. Time your protein. You just racked your weights after a strength session. Should you gulp down a protein shake to help build bigger, stronger muscles? That's basically the anabolic window theory, says Alan Aragon, a researcher who specializes in nutrition and body composition. By anabolic, he means muscle building. The early proponents of that theory basically said you need to consume protein and carbohydrates within 30 to 60 minutes after resistance exercise. And if you don't do that, you're going to delay recovery and ultimately delay muscle growth. Why? Quote, some short-term muscle studies suggested that when you consume protein and carbs immediately after resistance training, muscle protein synthesis is higher than if you delay the intake, says Aragon. But short-term muscle protein synthesis doesn't necessarily translate into bigger or stronger muscles over time. He explains, the results of longer studies that looked at muscular adaptations to resistance training were very hit and miss as to whether the protein-timed conditions were superior to conditions where the protein wasn't ingested immediately post-exercise. So we decided to run a meta-analysis of those studies. The analysis was funded by a company that sells protein powders. Aragon explains, we found that as long as you're getting enough total protein each day, even if you don't hit that narrow anabolic window, you're still going to get roughly the same degree of muscular gains. So there's no reason to think that eating protein after your workout is better than eating it at any other time of the day. His advice is, eat the way you normally would. Just keep in mind that extra protein only seems to help if you're young and doing intense strength training, and even then it only makes a small difference. Otherwise, you probably don't need to worry about protein unless you're getting too little, and most Americans eat plenty protein. Should you be walking on an incline? If you've seen walkers huffing their way up a steep treadmill at the gym lately, you may be witnessing people participating in a viral workout trend. The 12-3-30 workout, which means walking on a treadmill at a 12% incline at 3 miles per hour for 30 minutes, was first posted on TikTok in 2019. I know that things get popular on social media, and people think this fad is a new idea, says Julia Irafrate, a sports medicine physician and clinical assistant professor in the departments of orthopedics and rehab medicine at the NYU Grossman School of Medicine. The fact that somebody gave it this cute little label, the 12-3-30 workout, doesn't matter. Since humans started walking, we've been walking up hills. And walking up hills does a body good. When we walk uphill, our center of gravity gets pushed backwards. To compensate for that, we have to take higher steps and lean our torso forward to offset gravity. That engages the muscles of our posterior chain, which includes the glutes, hamstring, and calf muscles. But how much we engage those muscles varies. In one study, researchers had 10 young and 10 older adults walk on nearly 16% incline. The calf muscles of the older adults fired roughly 20% less, and their glutes fired 2 times more than those of the younger adults. The older folks' glutes also fired nearly twice as much at 5 and 10.5% inclines. As we age, our muscle mass tends to drop, and we feel the loss from small muscles like calves more than from big muscles like glutes. That study shows that bigger muscles have to pick up the slack. Because their glutes have to work harder, older adults may have more trouble walking uphill. But that doesn't mean they should quit trying. On the contrary, they should focus on strengthening the muscles around the hips. The muscles of the posterior chain are really important as we get older. They're necessary for going from sitting to standing and will help you maintain your mobility and independence. What else can walking uphill do? It's going to boost your heart rate more than walking on flat ground, which is going to help with cardiovascular health. It will also condition your body for more realistic terrain. Uphill walking can help you navigate uneven surfaces, walking up and over curbs, and so on. You'll also be taking deeper breaths, which is going to expand your lung capacity. And you'll burn more calories than walking on level ground. But before you lace up your sneakers and ramp up the treadmill to 12%, there are a few things to keep in mind. 12% is really a steep incline. A lot of people end up holding on to the handrails to do it. That transfers much of the effort to your upper body, which means you're not reaping the benefits of incline walking. If you have to hold on, you should drop the incline down. The same goes for people whose back pain is triggered by incline walking. Drop the speed or the incline while your body learns to adjust to that range of motion. Should you use a fitness tracker? The accuracy of your fitness tracker depends on how you wear it. For example, thanks to activities like writing, eating, and brushing your teeth, wearing your device on the wrist of your dominant hand may overestimate your activity. Some companies try to compensate for that. If you note while setting up the tracker that you wear it on the dominant hand, it adjusts the sensitivity of the algorithm. A fitness tracker uses arm swings as a proximity for steps, but it's an imperfect measure. If you're pushing a stroller or shopping cart, or if you're holding your cell phone and texting while walking, your wrist is stable and the device will tend to miss some steps. to test the accuracy of a wrist-worn fitness tracker. His team had 86 adults wear one along with a research-grade hip-worn pedometer while doing a treadmill exercise, walking or jogging at 4 miles per hour, treadmill walking at 3 miles per hour for 55 minutes, or their daily activities. The fitness tracker recorded about 6% fewer steps than the pedometer during both types of treadmill activity. That's not bad, but the fitness tracker recorded about 20% more steps than the pedometer when people were going about their day-to-day life. Why? Wrist-worn trackers may mistake arm movements like folding laundry or washing dishes for steps. To measure heart rate, fitness trackers shine light through your skin. That light gets refracted based on how much blood is in the vessels at the wrist. When your heart beats, there's a small surge of blood through your blood vessels, and the tracker registers that as a heartbeat. Just make sure the tracker isn't loose. Heart rate is measured best when the device is tight enough so that it doesn't move around. Some, but not all, studies show that skin tone may also affect the accuracy of fitness trackers. Newer devices often use multiple sensors, which may improve the accuracy of heart rate measurements, including in people with darker skin tones. How do trackers measure the calories you've burned throughout the day? The companies don't tell you, but we can be pretty confident in a couple of things. All trackers ask about your gender, height, weight, and age. The device probably plugs that data into a basic equation to estimate how many calories you burn at rest. Then it likely uses your heart rate and its internal accelerometer to create an algorithm that establishes the calories you burn when you're active. Just don't rely too heavily on the numbers. Alexander Montoya, an associate professor of clinical exercise physiology at Alma College, says, "I have not seen many studies suggesting that those calorie estimates are precise. Pretty universally across all types of fitness trackers, the error is high." In fact, in a recent review of the data from 22 studies, researchers reported that calorie burn measured by a variety of fitness trackers was off by an average of more than 30% for all brands. Montoya continues, "It will also depend on the activity. The watches underestimate calorie burn from cycling, for sure. Don't change what you eat based on what your device is telling you about calories." Should you use a fitness tracker? Montoya says you have to consider how the device affects you. Is it inspiring you to be more active? Are you learning new things about your behavior? Or are you just stressed out about your step goal? Are you moving away from activities that are good for you just because they don't register on this device? I've worn a tracker for the past 10 years, and I recently stopped because I know enough about my behavior patterns now. I know that on most days I meet my goals. I know that my resistance training days I take fewer steps, and that's okay. And I'll be honest, it's kind of a liberating thing not to have the device buzzing at me, telling me to get up and move. And that's the end of the Healthy Living Podcast, being recorded on September 29, 2023. This is Martha Atiyi. Thank you for listening, and goodbye from Al Radio.